Good day and welcome everyone to today's webinar on green remediation sponsored by the Green Remediation Subcommittee of EPA's Engineering Forum. My name is Hillary Thornton and I'm one of the co-leads of the Green Remediation Subcommittee as well as being a remedial project manager in EPA's Region 3 office in Philadelphia. I'll be moderating today's session titled Your Role in Green Remediation Implementation and Case Studies in Green Remediation, This Year's Models and Tools. This is the first of a three-part seminar series. The second one will be held on Tuesday, January 11th, 2011 from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and the third one will be held on Thursday, February 10th, 2011 from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll get started in a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I'd like to go over a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. If you have not checked in for today's seminar, please take a moment to do so. If you have questions for any of today's presenters that are not answered during today's webinar, you may send them to the presenters directly or send them to me at thornton.hillary@epa.gov. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, we request that you put your phone on mute during the seminar. We'll have a Q&A session near the end of each hour, at which point you are welcome to take your phone off mute and ask your question. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, we ask that you take a moment right now to hit star and mute your line. When we get to the question and answer period, you can hit #6 to unmute the phone. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. Again, keep us on mute. Please do not put us on hold. For those of you online, you should have clicked on the agenda for today's go-to-session icon and should be on slide number 1 of the presentation. The main page contains the slides, above which you will find navigation icons. You may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide. You do not need to wait until the Q&A period to submit your questions if you're one of our online participants. In fact, we encourage you to submit your questions in advance of the Q&A session, as long as you're typing them in electronically. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you may be reached, and we'll try to help you troubleshoot your problem. The presenter will be announcing the number of the slide to which he or she is moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. As stated earlier, we will have question and answer session after each half of the webinar. I'd like to bring to your attention the additional resources link at the bottom of the front page where we've assembled a series of documents and websites directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. Lastly, this event will be recorded and archived on the CLUIN website. Within 1 to 2 weeks, you'll be able to download it in several formats or replay it online. Subscribe to our CLUIN podcast to receive new archived seminars as they become available at www.cluin.org/live. Let's kick off this session. In May 2010, EPA held its National Association of Remedial Project Managers meeting in Arlington, Virginia. One of the most well-attended sessions was on green remediation. Because of its success, members of EPA's Technical Support Project Engineering Forum In particular, the EF's Green Remediation Subcommittee have divided this full-day session into 3 2-hour parts and are bringing back a number of the same talks as online seminars this winter. This is the first of 3 sessions. EPA's definition of green remediation includes the practice of considering the environmental effects of remediation strategy, i.e., the remedy selection and the implementation approach, early in the process, and incorporating options to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup action. Some practices are quite mature, such as construction site best management practices, including stormwater runoff management and construction and demolition, C&D, debris recycling. Others are still emerging, including the use of renewable energy sources such as wind and solar to power remedial systems. Over the 3 sessions, the online training introduces you to the key technical, policy, and application aspects of green remediation. Before I turn it over to the first of today's 7 speakers, I remind phone participants to put your phones on mute. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, hit *6 now, and again, please do not put us on hold. First of today's speakers is Suzanne Wells of the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation in EPA headquarters. Welcome, Suzanne. I hope you're on the line.
I am on the line. Can you hear me, Hillary?
Yes, I hear you very clearly.
All right, great. Well, we're now on slide 7, and the title is National Corrections to Advance Superfund Green Remediation. My name is Suzanne Wells. I work in the Superfund program at headquarters, and today I'm going to give a brief update on the Superfund Green Remediation Strategy, talk a little bit about Executive Order 13514, and also discuss our efforts to implement one of the action items in our green remediation strategy, which is where we set a goal of powering our sites using 100% renewable energy sources. I'm now on slide 9. There are many we call policy drivers moving us in the direction of green remediation practices at our sites. And we'll discuss these during the presentation. One is Executive Order 13514. The other is the agency's strategic plan, which discusses greening our cleanup. We also have from our Assistant Administrator's Office in the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, a Green Remediation Principles, which was issued last year. And then falling underneath that, we have our Superfund Green Remediation Strategy, along with regional clean and green or green remediation policies. Now on slide 10. The agency's strategic plan for 2011 through 2015 was actually issued in just September of this year. And under the strategic plan, Goal 3 deals with cleaning up communities and advancing sustainable development. And within that goal, it discusses reducing the energy use and environmental footprint during the investigation and remediation of sites. And if you want to find out more about the agency's strategic plan, it is available on the EPA website. Slide 11. This is the where the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Remedial Response, Emergency Response, issued Green Remediation Principles in August of 2009, and it sets a goal for green remediation across all of the waste programs, including Superfund, RCRA, our underground storage tanks program, and brownfields. What is very important with the policy is that it talks about any of our green remediation practices need to be consistent with existing laws and regulations, and they must be protective of human health and the environment, must comply with all applicable laws and regulations. We must consult with communities regarding the response action impacts that we are going to have. And it recommends that if any of you have read the green remediation primer that was issued 2 years ago. Our green remediation principles talk about being considering what are the five core elements of green remediation, to look at the total energy use and potential for renewable energy use at the sites, to look for ways to reduce air pollutants and greenhouse gas emissions, to look for ways to conserve water use and to reduce the impact on water resources, to try to enhance our materials management at site and reduce the amount of waste that is produced, and to also look for sustainable land management practices where we promote better protection of the ecosystem. We began in actually 2008 developing a Superfund green remediation strategy. I am now on slide 12. And we issued in August of 2009 a draft Superfund green remediation strategy for public comment. We received about 30 comments on the strategy. And then in September of this year, we released our final Superfund green remediation strategy. That strategy is available on the Superfund website. It's also available on the CLUIN website. And in our strategy, we outline 9 key action items. There's 40 specific actions within those 9 key action items to promote green remediation. And the action items fall into 3 primary categories. One is developing policies and guidances to help promote green remediation. The second area is to develop resources to help our site managers implement green remediation practices at sites. And the third area is to evaluate the impact that our green remediation activities are having at really promoting green remediation practices at sites. I'm now on slide 13. All of our 10 regional offices have developed their own green remediation policies. Many of them are called clean and green policies. Each of these policies you can look at if you go to our CLUIN website. And all of the policies, they align with our national policies, but some include some additional regional preferences above and beyond what we have in the national policy. For example, there are some of the regions have placed more emphasis on using recycled materials to substitute for virgin materials at sites, and some of our regions have greater emphasis on the use of clean diesel technologies in their clean and green policies. Executive Order 13514 was signed by the President in October of 2009, and it requires it actually sets out a goal for federal agencies to measure, report, and reduce their greenhouse gas emissions from both direct and indirect activities. And it provides a timeline for federal agencies to establish greenhouse gas reduction targets. I'll just, as a brief aside, EPA, most of this executive order deals with the operation of federal buildings, and EPA currently purchases renewable energy credits to help us in meeting our goal for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the operation of the EPA facilities. There is, however, within Executive Order 13514, mention of the kind of the non-direct energy activities associated with what is called the government remediation of private sites. And it says that we are to try to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions from the government remediation of private sites. And it's included in what is called Scope 3. We're actually an optional reporting activity for greenhouse gas emissions. But going on to slide 15, in the executive order, it discusses the difficulty in addressing many of the scope 3 emissions, primarily because of the difficulty in collecting data about the greenhouse gas emissions that come from these sources. And it lays out a number of ways to determine whether or not agencies should actually count scope 3 emissions. And it says that if the emissions are sizable enough to warrant inventorying, it talks about the feasibility and cost of collecting the data. It also discusses the level of influence that an agency may have in reducing emissions, and discusses estimating the cost of measuring and making any reductions. I'm now on slide 16. We did look at the emissions that are coming from Superfund sites, and we determined that the emissions are sizable enough to warrant inventorying. We've made estimates of the amount of energy that is used in the remediation of hazardous waste sites that are cleaned up under Superfund, and we actually made some rough estimates that we would probably be purchasing in the area of in excess of $1 billion in energy between 2008 and 2030. We also believe that Superfund can have a great influence in encouraging the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions during the cleanup of a site by showing leadership in the green remediation field. While it is challenging to collect the data on energy use on a site basis, and it's challenging because the data exists with hundreds of site contractors and individual site managers, and we currently do not have a requirement for reporting these data, and we don't have a system set up to collect the data. However, we have been doing work with a representative sample of sites and doing some real site validation of our statistical estimates. And we believe that through our, statistical estimates and the real site validation, we can come up with energy usage and greenhouse gas emission data. Finally, we have learned a great deal from individual regional site experiences on greenhouse gas emission reductions and the impacts on energy site costs. So all of these things have led us to moving forward with, even though we are in scope 3 and we're an optional part of scope 3, we still believe that we want to try to report our greenhouse gas emissions from activities that we do in Superfund to try to green our cleanups. I'm now on slide 17, and in our green remediation strategy under what is key action item 3.1, we have set a goal of establishing a practice to maximize the use of renewable energy with a goal of using 100% renewable energy to power site operations. And in the strategy, we lay out three ways that the program can do this. We can do it through on-site production of electricity or some other form of on-site production of energy. We can do this through green power purchases from local electric service providers, and we could also do this through the purchase of renewable energy certificates. Our experiences to date on maximizing the use of renewable energy at sites, we do have numerous sites across the country that are using renewable energy to power on-site operations. If you go to our CLUIN website, there are a number of examples of site-specific situations. We have sites with landfills at it that are capturing methane from the landfills and using the methane to power on-site operations. We have a mining site out in Colorado where they have installed a small hydro power plant that is being, it's coming online in 2011 and will be powering a portion of the site operations there. So there are multiple examples where we're using on-site opportunities to use renewable energy. Region 2 actually has been our leader in this area because they included in their regional green remediation policy a preference for using 100% renewable energy to power site operations. And throughout this past year, they have taken 20 sites and they have made green power purchases through their local utility providers. And it's actually been, I think, a very successful effort that Region 2 has embarked upon. And it's shown that it's very doable and it's actually quite easy to do. I'm now on slide 19. EPA, as an agency, has a great deal of experience in purchasing renewable energy credits. We have a program that is in our air office that is called the Green Power Partnership, and it is a program, it's a voluntary program that supports organizations in their procurement of green power. EPA is actually the second largest purchaser of green power in the federal government, and all of EPA's offices, through the purchase of these renewable energy credits, claim the use of green power for electricity needs in all of the EPA facility offices and laboratories across the country. In looking at how EPA is planning to implement our goal of using 100% renewable energy to power site operations, we do currently have some sites where they are doing the on-site production. We have a few sites where we are doing the purchases of green power through local utilities. But we are also working with the EPA Green Power Partnership and our Sustainable Facilities Practices Branch, which does the bulk purchasing of renewable energy credits for the agency. And we are beginning to explore doing a bulk national renewable energy credit purchase to help us meet this goal. We have a number of things that we must do before we're going to be able to move forward with that. One of the primary things is that we are working to better estimate and refine our estimates for the program's national energy use. But there has been a substantial amount of work that's gone into that so far, and we are confident that we will be able to come up with a solid estimate for energy use in the program across the country. And we are also looking at a number of issues that in the Superfund program we have to deal with concerning cost recovery and some other issues, but we are currently working to resolve those issues, and we expect to make a recommendation in 2008 on ways that the program is going to meet this goal of using 100% renewable energy to power site operations, and we anticipate that doing some type of bulk national purchase of renewable energy credits will be a key component in meeting that goal. So that is the end of my prepared slides. And Hillary,
Thanks, Suzanne. We're going to take questions at the end of this first hour. So as a reminder, phone participants should hold your questions until then, and online participants can submit questions anytime, but we won't be answering them right away. If you go ahead and submit them now while you're thinking of them, that would be good. Our next speaker is going to be Laura Matthews, also of EPA headquarters. Laura works on the Repowering America's Land Initiative and will be giving us an update on that. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks, Hillary. So I think this is a nice segue from Suzanne's presentation on green remediation. I work in EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, and that office contains the Superfund program, brownfields, RCRA corrective action, an emergency response program, and our leaking underground storage tanks program. So I'm the staff lead for an initiative that promotes the siting of renewable energy on contaminated sites, Repowering America's Land. So on slide 22, today I will cover why EPA is promoting renewable energy on contaminated sites, tell you just a little bit about a few of our repowering tools, and then tell you about our current management plan. So on slide 23, a lot of these sites have aspects of them that make them attractive to both communities and to renewable energy developers. A lot of these sites have existing infrastructure in place from when they were operating facilities such as transmission lines, roads, railways. We've seen on these sites that there are lower transaction costs for some of the sites, and also there's improved public support and faster permitting and zoning on some sites. Because these sites have often been abandoned for a number of years, communities and local governments are eager to see them return to a productive reuse, and therefore they may be willing to speed up the process more so than with a pristine green space. For local communities, they can get a lot of benefits out of putting renewable energy on previously contaminated sites as well. It increases the economic value for the property. It furthers environmental sustainability by maximizing land use. It reduces the stress on green fields, and it provides clean energy for use on site locally or to the grid. And in some cases, it creates local green jobs. So on slide 24, I'll tell you a little bit about some of our repowering tools. I think one of the ones that folks find most useful is our Google Earth mapping tool. This has 11,000 sites that we have lat-long data for, which is almost 15 million acres of properties mapped across the country. We worked with the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab to screen those sites. So our Google Earth tool has information on how far the sites are from the road, how far they are from transmission lines, how many acres they are, and information on their different resource potential for wind and solar, biomass, and geothermal. We also provide technical assistance. We have success stories available online of those projects that have already been developed, and we have information on renewable energy and contaminated land redevelopment incentives for each state. So all of that can be found on our website, epa.gov/renewableenergyland. So slide 25 is a picture of what our Google Earth tool looks like. So all the different dots you see here are different contaminated properties across the country. And the different color is associated with a different type of property. For example, yellow dots are abandoned mine lands, and red dots are RCRA corrective action sites. On the left of the Google Earth tool, you'll see that it has different types of renewable energy. So depending on your interest, you can click on a specific type of renewable energy if you're just interested in looking at wind, for example, and everything except the wind dots will disappear. So slide 26 shows how you can zoom into the specific part of the country that you're interested. This is a picture of Arizona, and you can actually zoom in much, much closer. Those of you who have used Google Earth before know this. So you can really zoom in and see the tops of houses or tops of landfills out there. So the way Google Earth works, you click on a specific site, and this pop-up box comes up, and you can see near the top it tells you exactly where the landfill is located, how many acres it has, what type of program it falls under. And then in that box up towards the top of the page, based on our initial screening that we did with the National Renewable Energy Lab, it contains information on what types of renewable energy it looks like are feasible at this site. So you can see this site has a lot of options for concentrated solar power and PV, biopower, geothermal, etc. Just above that box, there's a link, cleanup program information. When you click on that link, that will actually take you to a web page specific for that site. And that web page often has information on who the site owner is, who to contact at that company, who the EPA manager is for that site, and how far along in the cleanup process that specific site is. In addition to the Google Earth tool, you can see down towards the bottom of this pop-up box, there's another link for Renewable Energy Excel spreadsheet, and you can also download this directly from our website. This Excel spreadsheet contains all of the contaminated properties in a sortable way. They're currently arranged by state, so you can, instead of clicking on sites one by one, instead you can go to Arizona, for example, and look there for all the sites that are above X number of acres or all the sites that look like they'd be good candidates for solar, for example. So moving on to slide 28, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the technical assistance that we offer in conjunction with the National Renewable Energy Lab. So in addition to using them to help screen our sites, we partnered with them last year to conduct feasibility studies on specific sites across the country. So they are doing 12 site-specific analyses and one alternative gas station project. And on our website, we currently have one completed feasibility study up, and a couple more will be ready in the next month or so. So these analyses will include determining the best renewable energy technology for the site, the optimal location on that site for placement of the renewable energy, how much renewable energy is feasible at that site, return on the investment, and the economic feasibility and financing options for the project. So what this feasibility study will be a tool for communities to use when they're seeking developers for the site.
Do you know why they did that?
Oh, I'm sorry, could someone put their phone on mute? So a number of those projects are for utility scale renewable energy, but there are a few of them that are for green remediation. For example, there's a site in California that is a remote site, and they currently truck truck the power up the mountain to power the remediation, and it gets really cold in the winter, and so they can't remediate the site then. So NREL is working with the site manager to determine if they can put up wind and solar to help power that site in a much cleaner way. And there's a fact sheet on that project and other sites on the repowering website. So in addition to the maps and the other tools I've already told you about, this past year we met with stakeholders in four meetings held across the country. And the purpose of those meetings was to find out more about what barriers exist to using contaminated properties for renewable energy and to hear suggestions for how to overcome those barriers. So some of the barriers we heard, there were a lot of misconceptions and uncertainties surrounding liability relief protections. People said there weren't guidelines for how to develop on landfills or if you can put renewable energy on a site while it's still being cleaned up. People weren't always sure who they could contact at EPA. They said communicating with utilities was very difficult. Communities often don't have expertise in developing renewable energy. And also a lot of folks at the meeting said that, you know, well, it sounds like a good idea, but we don't think these sites are economically viable. So we need to show that in some cases there are economically viable projects on contaminated lands. So based on those stakeholder meetings, we worked with a repowering team made up of headquarters and regional folks, and we developed a 2-year management plan. So a couple of those action items in the plan were expanding the toolbox of resources for use by folks at EPA, our state partners, and various stakeholders. So a couple things that we want to put in that toolbox are some guidances to help folks to, who want to develop solar on landfills. We also want to take some of our success stories and expand those into broader case studies that really go into the details of how the site was developed, what barriers did they initially face, and how were those overcome. We're also conducting a webinar series. Our next webinar is on December 15th, and it will provide information on the assistance that Department of Energy gives to state and local governments. So if you're interested in attending that, you can find it on the CLUIN website. We're also looking to clarify liability protections. Our Google Earth tool only contains those sites that EPA currently has lat-long data for, and we'd like to explore adding other sites that states have in their databases. And also, we want to work with our federal partners more to leverage their expertise and to encourage other agencies that manage contaminated lands to consider those contaminated parts of their sites before green space locations when they're siting renewable energy facilities. So that's all from me. On slide 31, you can find my contact information. If you have any questions, feel free to ask them, during the session, or you can call or email me. And again, the website for the Repowering webpage is at the bottom there.
Thanks, Laura. Phone participants, please continue to hold your questions for a bit longer. Online participants, go ahead and submit your questions anytime, but we won't be answering them just yet. Our next speaker is Ginny Lombardo of EPA's New England region, Region 1. She'll give us a brief update on green remediation activities in Region 1. I heard from Ginny earlier this morning, and they had a big internet outage at their regional office, so I hope Ginny has worked it out to be on the phone with us.
Hi, Hillary. I'm on.
Great.
But I do not have the entire presentation because I still am unable to get online. So I'm just going to say next slide, but I don't have the slide number because I'm only going off my individual presentation.
Okay.
So as Hillary introduced me, I'm one of the green remediation coordinators in Region 1, and I share that role with John Pajerski in the region. And I'm going to move on to the first slide, the Region 1 Green Remediation Approach. I'm happy to be following on after Laura because a lot of what we have done in the region is try to facilitate opportunities for renewable energy redevelopment of contaminated sites. That's pretty much been a major portion of what we've been working on in the region in the area of green remediation. The region is handicapped by low solar and wind resource. Some of our New England states have some really great incentive programs that make renewable energy projects viable in this region. Initially, we focused on federal facilities for a number of reasons. They have large parcels of land. A lot of our BRAC sites are undergoing redevelopment, so we have large-scale redevelopment opportunities there. There's existing grid access and utility infrastructure. Examples like BRAC sites already have property management organizations in place that are looking for redevelopment opportunities, and federal facilities are subject to the same executive orders that Suzanne was referring to in her discussion. And we were hoping to really use these renewable energy opportunities to establish some successes and really build some momentum in the region for other renewable energy and other green remediation projects and opportunities. Moving on to the next slide, some site-specific technical support examples. A couple of these were made possible through Laura's program, the Repowering America's Lands Initiative, through the interagency agreement that Laura referred to with NREL. For instance, the work at Naval Station Newport and MMR, a lot of the work that we did there, we did with the assistance of NREL support. We also did at Fort Devens a remediation system evaluation, which is an optimization effort done primarily at pump and treat systems, and they've been done for years and years. But in the one that we did at Fort Devens, we try to add in some green remediation elements and really try to look at opportunities not only to optimize the system, but to improve its energy efficiency and also look at the economic and technical feasibility of using renewable energy to system. Some of the other sites I have here, at the Naval Shipyard, we've used some regional funding and to do a feasibility study for looking at renewable energy opportunities on the landfill. New London Subbase, very similar project, and Brunswick. And then separately, we've also looked at private side sites, but primarily fund lead sites, doing a feasibility study for evaluating whether rooftop solar could be used to fund the remediation systems at those sites. Next slide, general efforts. As Suzanne referred to, all of the regions have their own specific green remediation policies. Region 1's policy was issued this past February. Some other things we've done generally is we held a UMass Amherst conference. We co-hosted that with EPA headquarters and Massachusetts DEP and others, and the focus of that conference was on green remediation. It was held in June of this past year. There were about 500 participants. It was a very successful conference. As a result of the success of that conference, we're going to be holding another one this coming June 1st through 3rd in next summer, also at UMass Amherst. It's going to be on sustainable remediation, covering both green remediation focus and more broader sustainability issues focuses. Another general thing we've been working on with a couple of other regions 2 and 3 in headquarters, and with the LMOP, who I'm sorry, I should have defined that as the Landfill Methane Outreach Program. They have been working with us on developing a landfill methane screening tool. Suzanne explained how there are many landfills out there that are reusing their landfill methane gas for converting that into energy. And all of the commercial scale projects that with that opportunity have really already been developed, but we're trying to find opportunities where it may not be commercially viable but may still be cost effective to go ahead and do methane recovery and energy capture there. Next slide. Some of the things that we've been doing to try to facilitate renewable energy development opportunities. Laura talked about the Google Earth map program that you can access through the Repowering America's Land Initiative website. That information gives some good general information on all of the NPL and other contaminated sites throughout the country that have our potential for renewable energy redevelopment. However, in order to really evaluate whether or not those sites have true feasibility, we were trying to, you know, take that analysis one step further. So we have looked at the Massachusetts NPL sites, since Mass does have some really good renewable energy, particularly solar redevelopment incentives here in the region. And we've taken the, you know, kind of the list that you can get off of the Google Earth site, and then talk to all of the individual RPMs and try to find the information in the Google Earth program with additional site-specific information on ownership status, cleanup status, how many acres are actually potentially available for renewable energy redevelopment, and try to get that information into the right hands. We've been participating. There's a lot of interest here in the region from solar energy developers and consultants, so we've been trying to participate in meetings and discussions with them, trying to get them the information, trying to connect them with the right people, connect them with the property owners, connect them with the RPMs in a way that it can facilitate projects moving forward. And I have listed here a number of kind of things that are in the works in the region where solar or renewable energy development is being considered or evaluated or planned. My last text slide is just some next steps that we're hoping to work through in this coming fiscal year. In 2011, we're looking at adding green remediation to our management reviews of remedies. So when we're, you know, before we go to the ROD, when we're looking at remedies, making sure that we've considered green remediation and choosing our remedies. We're looking at adding green remediation language to our contract enforcement orders. We're, you know, trying to make sure that we're tracking the success of the work that we have done to date, and try to make sure that we get the highlight those successes possibly in a web page. We're looking at doing another remediation system evaluation with a green remediation component at some of one or more of our high-cost, high-energy fund lead Superfund sites. We're continuing to look for ways that we can offer technical support to facilitate these type of projects, continuing to facilitate discussions between all the parties to try to facilitate renewable energy redevelopment on contaminated land. And we're making sure that we're coordinating our efforts with our state counterparts. And my last slide is just my contact and John Pajerski's contact information. And I'll hand it back to you, Hillary.
Thanks, Ginny, for working through those technical difficulties to present for us today. We really appreciate it. Our final speaker this hour is Kristen Jackalone of EPA Region 2 in New York. She'll give us a brief update on green remediation activities in Region 2. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you, Hillary. As Hillary just said, my name is Kristen Jackalone, and I am a project manager in the Region 2 Superfund program, and I'm the green remediation coordinator for the region. I'm going to give a brief description of our policy as well as some of the accomplishments that we've had and some of the challenges that we're facing. I'm on slide 40. Our clean and green policy was issued on March 17th, 2009. The policy applies to all of our Superfund cleanups, both fund and PRP lead, federal facilities, our brownfields program, and also covers EPA lead RCRA corrective action projects. Slide is our policy states a preference for all green remediation practices at all sites, but establishes touchstone practices that must be conducted unless there is a site-specific reason why it is not practical. Touchstones include the purchase of renewable energy to power 100% of a site's electricity needs, materials reuse, reduction and recycling practices, the use of clean diesel fuels, technologies and practices, and methane capture at landfills for flaring or power production. We currently have small teams evaluating other green remediation practices to see if there's value in adding to our required touchstone practices. What will determine if a practice can be a touchstone is if it has a widespread implementability with results that can be measured. On slide 42, in order to promote our clean and green policy and raise awareness of green remediation in the region, we established a regional work group in October of 2008 to assist first in creating the policy and second in implementing the policy. The work group has cross-divisional representation and is comprised of subgroups with differing responsibilities. since the policy was signed, it has consistently been cited in enforcement and decision documents and has also been incorporated in statements of work in several of our contracts and interagency agreements. We've received funding to create a database to assist in tracking our accomplishments. It should be completed hopefully by the end of this year and will allow our individual project managers to input and track their data on a site-by-site basis, and will also allow the work group to identify those sites that need assistance. We have found that there is a divide among project managers in our region between those that are on board and moving forward and those that need assistance and a little motivation. Now on slide 43. Our accomplishments since implementation of the policy in 2009 through this past June include the reduction of 4,585,568 pounds of carbon dioxide equivalents, or the 2,080 metric tons is the other way people look at it. This has been accomplished through the purchase of renewably generated electricity at 17 NPL sites, the reduction, reuse, and recycling of materials at 10 NPL sites, clean diesel technologies and practices at 6 NPL sites. We've reduced air toxics by retrofitting 3 EPA-owned excavators, and we switched 83 non-road vehicles from low-sulfur diesel to ultra-low-sulfur diesel prior to the regulatory required date. That was this past June. And we've used green concrete at 2 NPL sites. We plan on holding several training sessions this fiscal year to build on the momentum of our successes. Well, slide 44. Some of the challenges we're facing here in the region include debunking some of the green remediation myths that it takes too long, costs too much, and that responsible parties don't want to do it. Our experience has been that cost increases for our touchstone practices are minimal compared to the total project budget for a site. And in the case of materials management, we've saved money on disposal costs. Some of our more interesting examples of green remediation practices are actually being conducted at some of our responsible party sites. Another challenge is identification of sites where the project managers need assistance. Currently, our most easily tracked sites are those that are being managed for us by the Army Corps of Engineers. Sites that are PRP lead or are not in construction phase are being reported by individual project managers, and they believe that data is coming into us sporadically. It's expected that once the database is up, it will assist us with showing which sites are submitting data and which ones are not. We are also struggling to find ways to engage those project managers who don't attend the training. We've found that most project managers are already practicing green remediation at their sites but aren't aware that they are because the choices that they made were not in response to our policy in particular, but because they made technical environmental sense at the site. We're hoping to focus this year on that message that green remediation is not one particular practice or technology, but it's the choices that we make at every stage of the cleanup process. And that is it for me. Thank you.
Thanks, Kristen. It's finally time to answer some of your questions. Let's start with one from the phone and then alternate between questions from the phone and questions that were submitted online. So anybody out there in phone land have a question for any of our first four presenters?
I have a question.
Hi, Dave.
I'll take one here from in my local room first. Just speak towards any one of the microphones.
This is Hugh Ngon. I'm an RPM in Region 3. And, you know, one of the things that we started to do is we started to look at purchasing renewable energy credits from some of our local electricity providers. And I guess this question is for Suzanne. In light of what you discussed, the bulk purchase of these renewable energy credits, is there value for individual regions to to be looking at their local electricity providers, or is this something that we should essentially just wait for you guys to take care of?
Well, I think it's certainly worthwhile for you to explore it. I hope within the next 2 to 3 months we're going to have we're going to know how and when we're going to move forward with a bulk renewable energy credit purchase. We have been having numerous meetings in the last couple months with our Office of General Counsel, with the Green Power Partnership, Sustainable Facilities Office, and with some of the agencies that have been involved in bulk renewable credit, energy credit purchases. We still have a couple of issues to work through, primarily some things dealing with cost recovery. If we do a bulk national purchase, how to track that back to individual sites. I don't think that any of the issues that have been presented to us so far are, you know, unsolvable. I think we just have to, you know, come up with an approach for how to deal with it. We don't want to be doing double purchases, though. So, and this will cost the program some additional expenses in doing it. And so I would encourage any region to consult with us at headquarters before you do move forward with doing any kind of renewable energy credit purchase. But the other thing I have to say, I honestly believe that we would not have this national policy if it had not been for the leadership that Region 2 has shown on this issue. And we're certainly learning a great deal from Region 2 and their experiences on doing the local utility green power purchases. So if any region is planning to move forward, please work with us, because I think there's a lot we can learn from you. But I think we all have to do this coordinated as a program, a national program, to avoid, you know, duplicate purchases.
Well, I'll be in contact with you then, Suzanne.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. Here's a question from online. Nikki DeForte, EPA Region 2, New York. When will EPA make guidance available for siting renewables at sites with ongoing cleanups?
Hi, this is Lura. Let me try to find our management plan. I think it's sometime in 2011. I don't have a draft of our management plan with the date on it exactly, but sometime in 2011, and that's available in the management plan. I think that's action 2 or 3.
Thank you. Another question from the phone?
Yes, I have a question. Actually, it's two parts. One, I'm interested, and this is Rick Moran. I'm with MACTEC Engineering. First part of it is, what type of return on investment does EPA consider when you're looking at renewable energy on a site? And then second part is, how does the cost between purchasing a bulk credit compare to an on-site generation of renewable energy?
This is Suzanne. I'll try to start out with that. We don't have any specific guidance on return for investment, but with the Superfund statute, we are supposed to be selecting cost-effective remedies. You know, we've got, for example, the Summitville site in Colorado. I think they're looking at about a 7 to 8 year return on investment for the small hydro system that they've installed. But that's also a system that they expect is going to operate for many, many years. I mean, that's a very, very long-term cleanup. So it's been on a site-by-site basis, and I think we've been trying to, you know, just look at reasonable, cost-effective, remedy decisions. In terms of the difference between local utility green power purchases and a bulk renewable energy credit purchase, I won't be able to answer that question until we actually do a bulk renewable energy credit purchase, but I can say that it's very similar to what we all know about today on, you know, wholesale, large-scale bulk purchases. You pay less when you do that than if you go to, you know, purchasing one individual item. Do not hold me to this, but just based on our comparison with what Region 2 has been paying through their local utility purchases for 17 sites, and based on what EPA pays when they do the bulk renewable energy credit purchases for powering the facilities and laboratories, I think we're looking between a 50 and 75% savings by going with a bulk purchase. But there's still, we still have to go through this process, and so we can't tell you exactly, but just based on that, and those are two different things we're comparing right now, but there is a fairly significant savings by doing the renewable energy credit purchases.
Thanks, Suzanne. We need to get started with the second half of our green remediation webinar. I promise that we will record. There are a number of online questions which we haven't gotten to. Those are being recorded and will be answered after the fact. But we do need to move on so that we can finish in a timely manner. I ask that any of you who may have taken your phone off mute for the Q&A session, put it back on mute by pressing *6 now or muting it locally in whatever way that you do. Our next speaker is Ms. Rashmi Mathur of EPA's Middle Atlantic Region, Region 3, and she'll present a case study on the Sharon Steel Ferrule Work Site.
Good afternoon. My name is Rashmi Mathur, and I'm going to update you on the Sharon Steel pilot scale study. Next slide. Oh, sorry, next slide. The Sharon Steel Company produced steel, and a lot of their byproducts were dumped on the site, and as a result, the site is mostly comprised of steep slag piles, wetlands, surface ponds, and the Shenango River, which is borders the eastern side of the site. On the southern half of the site, we have a prospective purchaser agreement with a party who is mining the slag and using it with asphalt for making roads. The site, next slide, please. The site itself is a 400-acre site located in western PA in the town of Sharon. In this slide, you can see both there's a northern half and the southern half of the site, and the street in the center is Ohio Street. And basically, that wiggly thing on the east is the Shenango River. In the remedial investigation, the primary contaminant of concern found in the slag and sludge were the metals. Next slide, please.
Slide 48.
In this slide, actually, you can see how steep the slag piles are. And in the risk assessment, we found that the primary risk driver was inhalation and ingestion of metals from the slag and sludge. And in addition, there was metal infiltration in the shallow groundwater, and then the runoff going into the Shenango River as well. Next slide. The darkened area, as you can see from the soil, is the sludge, and those were the worst contaminated areas in regards to metals. On the top, you can see the railroad, which basically the railroad cars would come in and dump the slag. Next slide. There's also an asphalt plant on the northern half of the site, and there is risk in regards to the inhalation of metals for these workers. The remedy that we selected on this site when we were looking at, you know, the options, since it's a very large site, we came up with a biosolid cap, which was the most inexpensive alternative for this site. Next slide. Some of the RI remedial investigation recommendations include minimizing dust exposure, minimizing contaminated slag and sludge exposure, eliminating the runoff, which is going into the Shenango River and wetlands, and reducing the contamination into the shallow groundwater, and restoring habitat value of the barren areas. Next slide. So in design, what we did is we conducted multiple pilot scales to test the optimum percentage of biosolids on the slag. And we tested some of the parameters we looked at was the time of seeding, tested whether pine bark and compost would be an added benefit. And then afterwards, after we had a couple of pilot scales, we looked, went back to those same plots and looked at pH, metals, and earthworm bioassays in these plots. Next slide. So this slide shows the germination rate, and to what we found from this was that compost is very necessary to achieve acceptable germination for the vegetative cover for the cap. Also, the fall seeding is superior to spring seeding because in fall seeding it ensures that the seeds are available as early as possible for growth. Next slide. Again, in this slide, it's a slide for pH, and the compost was consistently reducing the pH for suitable growth for plants, and without the compost, the pH of the biosolids was too high for the plants to grow, even 2 years after the application. And in addition, we are going to be adding aluminum sulfate to slag in the biosolids mix. Next slide, please. This slide is showing the water retention with treatment, and what we found initially was that the biosolids, because they're in clumps, there was initially poor absorption. But through repeated freezing and thawing and through the weathering, the capacity to hold water improved. The compost also retains water immediately after application, and in addition, which was most important to us, we found that the optimum amendment for long term for the biosolid cap was a 15% with compost seeded in the fall. Next slide. This slide we're doing earthworm bioassays. And we found plots with compost and vegetation were comparable to controls as far as the earthworm bioassay results. And the plots without the vegetation were highly toxic, and this was probably due to the physical effects of the slag. Next slide. In this slide, if you look at the aluminum slide, that is showing the earthworm tissue concentration. And again, this is the most significant finding from this slide, was that the aluminum in the treated plots was less than the untreated by an order of magnitude when you were looking at the earthworm bioassay. Next slide. This shows just across the conception of the cap after cleanup. Next slide. In addition, the EPA Headquarters Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response was doing a carbon sequestration study on the site, and they had their own funding, and They were developing a protocol for carbon accounting after application of carbon-rich soil amendments in remediation. And they were using Sharon Steel and looking at the plots. And so some of the most promising ways for reducing the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is through the carbon sequestration. And initial results indicate that this cleanup approach may be applicable to large mining sites, which, you know, the site is 400 acres, so it's quite large. And in future, carbon sequestration at large sites may be able to be treated as tradable carbon credits, a great incentive for maybe PRPs in really cleaning these large barren sites. Next slide. We're currently in design. And next slide, I have my contact information. If you need any more information, please don't hesitate to contact me, email or phone.
Thanks, Rashmi. Once again, those of you on the phone, please hold your questions. Those of you online, go ahead and type them in now. I encourage that you mention the presenter and the slide number, if you can, and your online questions. That will help as we go back to get you answers later on after the fact. Our next speaker is Candace Jackson of EPA's Southeast Region, Region 4. She'll present a case study from her Barite Hill NV gold site, goldfield site, rather. Go ahead, Candace.
Thank you, Hillary. My name is Candace Jackson. I'm the remedial project manager in the Superfund division here in Region 4. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the Barite Hill site located in McCormick, South Carolina. The site's a former gold mining site located approximately 40 miles northwest of Augusta, Georgia in McCormick, South Carolina. The site was operated as a gold mining site from 1991 to 1995. And the PRP actually performed reclamation until 1999 before filing bankruptcy later that same year and abandoning the site. A removal action was conducted there in 2007 through 2008, and then the site was listed in 2009. Moving on to slide 64. We're having difficulty with our mouse right now. I'm sorry. Give us just a minute, Hillary. I'm sorry. Okay. So the next slide, number 64, actually is an aerial view of the area that was remediated. And a removal action took place, and you see the two waste rock piles, and there's also a main pit. Moving on to slide 65. So what were the main problems at the site? The main pit contained approximately 60 million gallons of water with an average pH of 2 and dissolved metals and then two waste rock areas. Slide 66. Leo Francandisi, an EPA OSC here in Region 4, worked with Mike Gobola from the United States Bureau of Reclamation to implement an innovative treatment technology for the main pit lake, and also worked with Joe Harrington from a company called Lexco. They first started by chemically neutralizing the pit lake and the water in the pit with lime, and then they implemented a patented carbon loading treatment methodology, and they pushed the majority of the waste rock back into the pit to submerge it. So that's what you see in those pictures right there. They also added methanol as food for sulfate-reducing bacteria, and the idea for the pit lake is to turn it into a giant sulfate-reducing bioreactor. Moving on to slide 68. So here's just a small schematic showing the before and after reclamation. As you can see the waste rock cap off to your right, and the gabion baskets and the riprap, and then a constructed spillway was also installed at the site. Moving on to slide 69. After Leo implemented the removal action, I partnered with the Idaho National Laboratory to design and install a monitoring system, a remote monitoring system out at the site. And in the center of the lake, there is an automated floating chemical sampler that's solar powered, off to the left-hand corner, there's a camera and lake-level sensor and a spillway sensor. That's where the spillway is. There are two monitoring wells on each of the waste rock areas that are also instrumented. And then the green dashed lines represent electric resistivity that we have across the waste rock capped areas. Moving on to slide 70. So the monitoring system objectives are to provide near real-time site performance information. It's a multi-sensor design to provide automated data collection, storage, and reporting. The system is self-calibrating, it's remotely controlled, and it's also accessible through a secure web page. So the monitoring parameters for the pit lake and groundwater include pH, ORP, DO, conductivity, and temperature. We, of course, have the lake level sensor again. We also have a MET station and a weather station out there. And the subsurface monitoring includes resistivity, temperature, and water levels. So this slide, slide 72, the gentlemen down, the folks down at the bottom are from Idaho National Labs, and this is actually while they were instrumenting the monitoring wells on the waste rock area. And let's move on to slide 73. That's just the YSI chemistry sensor. I'm sure a lot of us have seen those before. And here is the this is what it looks like in the shed that we have on land. Off to the left-hand picture that you see there shows the pinch valves and some of the pumps that we have. The middle photograph is the electric controllers that we have, the panel. And then the photograph to your right is the calibration fluids in the flow-through cell. Moving on to slide 75. Here, of course, is the camera and lake level sensor. And slide 76 shows the lake sampling, which is essentially the exact same as what we have on land. It samples automatically, and it's taken at 5-foot intervals from the surface to 55 feet below surface. And everything is solar powered. As you can see there, you can see the solar panels on the floating platform. Slide 77. So benefits and results. It helps us to understand the system dynamics and monitor the effectiveness of the remedy that LEO had implemented. It provides near real-time information and an early warning system in case of treatment failure. It monitors multiple parameters. It also reduces travel to the site, which is definitely green, and it's capable of running on power generated by wind or solar. Currently, the entire monitoring system is run on solar power. And that's it.
All right. Well, thank you, Candace. We have one more presentation to hear before it's time for our final Q&A session. Our final speaker, Karen Sherman, is from EPA's Pacific Southwest region, Region 9. Karen will present on a project she's been deeply involved with, looking at environmental footprint analysis. Go ahead.
Thanks, Hillary. So my name's Karen Sherman. I'm in EPA Region 9 in San Francisco, and I'm going to share with you some of the work that we're doing here in estimating environmental footprints. You've just heard from some of our regions, our other regions, on the good work that they're doing to reduce the environmental footprints of their cleanups. And this presentation will go ahead to explain and describe ways to actually measure those reductions that can be achieved. And this is the same presentation that Steve Armin gave in May at NARPA with a few updates. If we can move to the next slide. So just a quick overview of what I'll be talking about. I'm going to give a description of what is a footprint analysis in the first place. I'm going to describe the methods that we used in our pilot study to conduct a footprint analysis. I'm going to provide results of the footprint analyses and how they can be used at cleanup sites. And then I'm going to end with some observations and a quick wrap-up. Next slide. Is that 81? Yeah, okay, so we're on slide 81. Well, okay, so what I mean by a footprint analysis is an estimate of the resources used and emissions created during a site remediation. And we look at it in essentially four steps. First, we develop an inventory of the materials, activities, and services that are involved in the cleanup. And then second, we apply some of the principles of a life cycle assessment to compile footprints for key environmental parameters. And I want to emphasize here that this is not a life cycle assessment per se. There's one major step, at least, that would be in a life cycle assessment that we are not doing in our footprint analyses, and that is conducting an impact analysis. So we are not conducting the impact analysis in our environmental footprint analysis. And again, that impact analysis is an important part of a life cycle assessment. And then, so then the fourth thing that we do is ideally we would use the results of the environmental footprint analysis to reduce the footprint of the cleanup remedy. Slide 82. And then just briefly, the purpose of the pilot study. It's basically an academic study to explore how to conduct this kind of analysis. We are exploring the techniques that needed to be used analytically to get a footprint of your site. We wanted to acquire experience in estimating the environmental footprints of cleanup remedies. We wanted to develop a library of resources that could be used at other sites. And we also wanted to construct an analytic framework for use at other sites. And this framework is in the form of Excel spreadsheets. And we basically have separate tabs for each site remediation activity. Next slide, that'd be 83. Now, the pilot study is very complex, and this is just going to be a brief overview of some of the methods and the results. To find full results, you can go to EPA's webpage, and I'll give the actual web address at the end of this presentation. But we've posted there the final report, spreadsheets, and sources of information. Slide 84. So the scope of the pilot study, we looked at three different pilot sites shown here. Ramaki's Palo Alto and BP Wood River, those studies have been already completed and are posted on our website. We're underway on Travis Air Force Base, and we expect results in January of 2011. And as you can see, the main remedies at each of these sites: in situ bioremediation at Ramaki's Palo Alto, flooded remediation at BP Wood River, and an in situ bioreactor at Travis Air Force Base. Slide 85. A little bit more on the scope of the pilot study. We compared those primary remedies at each site with a couple of alternative remedies. As a result of that, we actually are exploring up to a dozen different remedy technologies in this pilot study, including bioremediation, phytoremediation, pump and treat, landfill capping, permeable reactive wall, and so forth. Slide 86. And I just want to mention, for each of these three pilot sites, the remedy had already been selected before we began the pilot study. So, again, this is an academic study kind of in retrospect, and the results were not used to select the remedies because they had already been selected. So now we're on slide 86. And this is a diagram illustrating how we organized the footprint analysis. For each pilot site, we looked at up to three remedies. Alternatives, that's alternatives A, B, and C at the top of the slide. For each of those remedy alternatives, we looked at up to six remedy components, such as site investigation, soil excavation, remedy construction, operations and maintenance, long-term monitoring, and decommissioning. Then for each of those three remedy components, we looked at three levels of activities: on-site, transportation, and off-site activities. And for each of those three levels of activities, we looked at 15 environmental parameters. And I'll be giving a little more information on some of these aspects of the scope of the pilot study in the next slides. But as you can see, it became intentionally very thorough and also complex in terms of the scope of the analysis. Next slide.
That would be slide 87. So this is to illustrate the boundaries of the pilot study. We looked at activities inside the fence line of the facility. We looked at transportation to and from the facility and then off-site activities. And this includes things like manufacturing of materials, energy production, and other support activities. And we went back to resource extraction wherever possible. Slide 88. This gives you some idea of the remediation materials that were involved in this pilot study. We are up to about 30 common remediation materials. Some examples are given here on this slide. And then four commonly used off-site services. Those are solid waste disposal, hazardous waste disposal, laboratory analysis, and wastewater treatment. And these are all what we consider off-site services to support the activities conducted on-site. And again, we obtained life cycle inventory data for each of these materials and services to the extent possible from resource extraction through manufacturing. Slide 89. These are the 15 environmental parameters that we looked at in the pilot study. I've grouped them here in kind of general categories of air emissions, energy, waste, water, and other contaminants. And we chose these 15 parameters because we found them useful in addressing questions of local, regional, or global interest. Slide 90. And we wanted to explore a number of different analytical techniques in our pilot study, so I'm showing you five here, and then I'll be giving some examples of results in the following slides. So first of all, we wanted to compare remedy technologies at each cleanup site. Second, we wanted to distinguish between on-site and off-site footprints. Third, we wanted to compare components of each remedy, or another way of saying that is phases of each remedy. Fourth, we wanted to look at key contributors to the footprint. And then fifth, we conducted sensitivity analyses. Each of these analytical techniques can help us focus on ways to reduce the environmental footprint of our cleanups. And so next slide, slide 91. Again, I'll be showing some examples of how each of these techniques can help the site manager at their site. So first of all, comparing remedy technologies at each site. This is an example from Ramic East Palo Alto. And at that site, we had bioremediation as the main remedy, and then alternatives of pump and treat, and then a hybrid that combined bioremediation and pump and treat. And this slide shows that in the simplest kind of broad brush approach, you can see that for CO2 equivalents emitted, bioremediation had the lowest footprint. And I want to remind the audience that CO2 emitted is only one of 15 environmental parameters in the pilot study, so we have this kind of slide for the 14 other environmental parameters also for Ramic East Palo Alto, where you can see how each of the remedy alternatives pan out and compare with each other. Next slide, and we're now on slide 92. Another example of comparing remedy technologies at each site. This is BP Wood River. Phytoremediation was the main remedy that was chosen at the site, and it was being compared against leachate and a landfill cover. And this is showing energy usage for the three different alternatives. And you can see that phytoremediation had the lowest energy usage. And so, again, this is kind of the simplest and most straightforward sort of result that we can get from a footprint analysis, that is, comparing the overall footprint of various remedy alternatives at a single site. Moving on to slide 93.
A second analytical technique that we looked at was distinguishing between on-site and off-site footprints. Now, it may be useful in some situations to make this distinction because on-site footprints will have importance for the local community, and off-site footprints may have importance for regional and global concerns. So here on this slide, the blue indicates on-site activities, and the red indicates off-site activities. And so you can see, for this is Ramakis Palo Alto, and again, each bar is for a separate remedy alternative at that site. And for HAPS, or hazardous air pollutants, the left-hand graph shows that the main contributor to the footprint of HAPS is from on-site activities, the blue parts of those bars. For NOx, at the same site and the same set of remedy alternatives, you can see we're seeing mostly red, and that indicates that the contributors to NOx are mostly from off-site contributors. The same site, same remedy alternatives. So this just will help the site manager understand what sort of reductions and where they may achieve by trying to reduce the footprint from in one remedy alternative versus another, and regarding on-site versus off-site. Slide 94. A third analytical technique is to compare components of each remedy. And this is at Ramakis Palo Alto. And now we're looking at a single remedy alternative. We're looking at bioremediation. And we're looking at the six stages or components of that remedy alternative: site investigation, excavation, construction, operations and maintenance, long-term monitoring, and decommissioning. And this slide illustrates that for particulates, the main contributor to the footprint is from the excavation component of the remedy, whereas for CO2 emissions, the main contributor to the footprint is from operations and maintenance. And again, this can help the site manager focus on certain components of the remedy when seeking to reduce the footprint of any of the 15 environmental parameters. And it also shows how that the distribution and the contributing factor or component may differ depending on which environmental parameter you're looking at. Moving on to slide 95. A fourth analytical technique was to identify key contributors to the footprint. And although the x-axis is scrambled a little bit here in this view, each of those bars represents a different contributor to the footprint. So, for example, we have diesel combustion and cement manufacturing and production. You have electricity production and all the different things that go into the remedy. And this is Ramakis Palo Alto, the pump and treat remedy. And as you can see, the greatest contributors are electricity production, carbon regeneration off-site, and wastewater treatment at a POTW. So and activities such as diesel combustion are represented by some of the smaller bars to the far left. So often diesel combustion and diesel usage is something that we try to minimize at sites, and that's really important and a good thing to work on. At the same time, for some sites, if that is all that the site manager works on, then it may really have a very small effect on the overall footprint. In this case, for Ramakis Palo Alto, you would want to work mostly on electricity production, carbon regeneration, and wastewater treatment to help make good reductions, significant reductions in the footprint for CO2. Next slide is slide 96. This is the same kind of approach, same kind of analysis for BP Wood River, and we're now looking at the landfill cover. And you can see that the distribution is different and the key contributors are different. Now, it is diesel combustion that is the key contributor,
well as gasoline combustion and off-site laboratory analyses. So I think the main message here is each site and each remedy will have a different sort of array of key contributors, and that to really know which key contributors to work on to reduce your environmental footprint, you may need to do some sort of analysis like this to really understand where you can get the biggest reductions. Next slide, slide 97. The fifth analytical technique, we conducted sensitivity analyses, and this is just illustrating one of them, where at Ronicky's Palo Alto for the pump and treat remedy, we looked at what would happen if we improved and refined the design of that pump and treat remedy. The primary analysis that we did was on a fairly quick sketch the design of a pump and treat alternative, and as we refined that the engineering design in steps 1, 2, and 3, each refinement of an improvement on the pump and treat remedy got us pretty significant reductions in CO2 emissions. Next slide. And in fact, we found that with all those three steps, and these are all, I should mention, hypothetical steps, not clear exactly how likely we would be able to put them into practice at the site, but still, hypothetically, the pump and treat remedy footprint was approaching at least order of magnitude of the bioremediation footprint for carbon dioxide emissions at Ronicky's Palo Alto. So this is just to illustrate how a sensitivity analysis could give you some incentive to see what the kinds of gains that could be accomplished by putting the effort into an engineering design that's improved over maybe just a more of a general sketch. Moving on to slide 99. And this is just an illustration of some extra sorts of analyses that you can also do in a footprint analysis. This is showing a year-by-year accounting of the CO2 emissions from a phytoremediation alternative at BP Wood River. And you can see how, according to our estimates, we would reach zero net CO2 emissions at year 20 for this remedy, and then would continue to decline after that in terms of the carbon dioxide emissions. And that is, of course, because of the carbon dioxide storage in the tree biomass. Slide 100. So now I want to move on to some observations, and I have six observations here. We're beginning to draw a lot of observations from this pilot study, and the full set of observations are posted on the website in the final reports for these pilot studies. And we should keep in mind that the observations that we have here actually may be different for different sites and different remedy technologies. And also, as we continue with the pilot study, we may be refining these observations on based on additional information that we're generating. So next slide, 101. First observation is that it will generally be important to include transportation and off-site activities in estimates of our environmental footprint. We saw that for some of the pilot sites and remedies that I showed slides for there earlier. And the pie chart there is just a hypothetical illustration where if for some sites and some remedy technologies, if you look only at on-site activities, you may be only getting a small piece of the whole footprint for that remedy. Slide 102. This is a second observation. Kind of goes along with the first. There may be hidden off-site contributors to the environmental footprints, and we found especially that wastewater treatment that off-site service, reactivation of granulated activated carbon, and laboratory analyses all may contribute a significant portion of the footprint. And those are all off-site activities that, in the past, we haven't really paid a whole lot of attention to. Next slide, 103. This is observation number three, and it's just to point out that in our first very preliminary work on the Romic site, we did a sort of quick environmental footprint analysis looking at only three environmental parameters. And the bioremediation alternative had the smallest footprint for all three, so we were ready to say, yes, the bioremediation alternative is the greenest alternative. Next slide. In the more robust analysis at Romic, we included all 15 environmental parameters. And in this case, some of the environmental parameters had bioremediation had a higher footprint for two of the environmental parameters shown in red and kind of equal to the other alternatives shown in yellow. And so although it still had more green than red or yellow, the bioremediation alternative did not look like such a shoe-in as it originally had. And our observation is that, it makes the judgment of which alternative is greener a little more difficult, and that judgment will depend on how the observer values the various environmental alternatives, environmental parameters, such as is CO2 more important than water use, are dioxins emissions more important than PM emissions, and so forth. Observation number four, this is slide 105. This is to point out that we did not combine environmental parameters into a single score for determining a best remedy. We avoided doing this because of the fact that there may be some overlap in our 15 environmental parameters, such as between energy usage and electricity and CO2 emissions. There's some overlap conceptually in those environmental parameters, and that the environmental parameters represent disparate items which do not have common denominators for comparison. So, for example, how do you compare water usage with PM particulate emissions? How do you compare hazardous waste generation with CO2 emissions? So they're not directly comparable. In order to do some sort of comparison, you would really need to do an impact assessment, which is would be the next step for a life cycle assessment. Next slide. Observation number five, this is just to remind the audience that these are all estimates. None of these numbers and graphs and charts are absolute exact numbers by any means. And so as we conduct pilot studies and environmental footprint analyses, we really need to keep in mind what are the degrees of uncertainty in our analysis. So just as some examples, we may not really know how long a remedy is going to last. So we may model a remedy extending for 3 years, and it may in fact end up extending 10 years, and we don't know that until we're down the road already. So we need to keep that sort of uncertainty in mind as we're interpreting the results of an environmental footprint analysis. In addition, there are some default assumptions that we tend to use, like transport of construction materials for 1,000 miles to get to the site, from the manufacturing to the of the materials to our site. That may be so, but our site may be closer to the manufacturing locations, and the transport may be only 100 miles. So some of these things we don't know for sure, and so we have to keep in mind that we're using default parameters in some cases. And then finally, the footprint conversion factors themselves are still a work in progress and are still being developed for many remediation materials and activities. And what I mean by this is that for example, what really is the carbon emissions that you can expect from regenerating a pound of granulated activated carbon? We estimated that, and we need to be aware that those numbers can always be improved. This is my final observation, and that's just that the footprint analysis is a balancing factor for remediation sites. It certainly is not a deciding factor. The remedies must first be protective of human health and the environment, and then we use the balance. We may then want to use the footprint information as a balancing factor after that. Next slide, and this is slide 108. So to wrap up, for anyone interested in conducting a footprint analysis, you really want to know your site. An accurate inventory depends on a good understanding of the site and the activities involved. You want to know the questions to be answered. This would really help streamline the footprint analysis. You don't want to be doing this sort of detailed analysis at every site, of course, but if you know your questions, then you can streamline the footprint and have the results in the format that is useful to you. One site does not fit all. Be alert for out-of-the-ordinary materials, activities, or emissions that may be part of the site remedy. And then consistent methodology is important, especially if you're comparing different remedies at one site or compiling results of footprint analyses at different sites. So next slide, this is just to acknowledge Doug Sutton of Geotrans, who did the technical and engineering support for the footprint analyses, and Carlos Pachon for headquarters and programmatic support. And then, of course, to our pilot sites, Ramic, BP, Wood River, and Travis Air Force Base, they provided information and support for conducting this this footprint analysis. I think there was one slide that didn't somehow make it up there. I just wanted to, oh yes, this slide. So 109, using the experience from this pilot study, we plan to continue at EPA conducting streamlined footprint analyses at sites where that information will be used either during remedy evaluation or to improve and reduce of remedies already in place. And we're also using the experience of conducting this pilot study to develop a methodology EPA-wide that will help provide a methodology for our site managers to use if they were to conduct this kind of analysis at their sites, with the overall goal, of course, always of reducing the environmental footprints of our cleanups. This is the final slide showing where you can find the final reports and also all of the supporting materials for Ramic East Palo Alto and BP Wood River. And again, we expect to be posting the information on Travis Air Force Base in January of next year. And I just wanted to emphasize that I definitely invite comments and suggestions. So anybody who is interested in looking at those reports, please feel free to provide me with any comments or suggestions on what you see there. We're always looking to improve the methodology, and so would love to hear any comments to help us improve it. Thank you, and so Hillary, I'll turn it back to you.
All right, thank you, Karen. That was the last of our presentation, so the remainder of the time on this webinar can be devoted to questions and answers. You may ask questions about any of the presentations, but I'm particularly interested in hearing questions having to do with the three presentations we just heard in the second half of the webinar, the two case studies, and then Karen's presentation on environmental footprint analysis. As before, I'll start with the phone and then alternate between questions from the phone and online. So, somebody on the phone want to speak up?
This is Bill Hagel, Region 3. I have a question. On the environmental footprint. I'm assuming that Geotrans did most of the calculations for the environmental parameters that you looked at. What tools were they using? For example, how did they calculate 2,800 pounds of particulates for the excavation activities at Ramic East Palo Alto? I didn't see that on the slides, and I'm sorry if I missed it, if you already said it.
All right, so when you say what tools did they use, we used a spreadsheet system that we developed ourselves, that Geotrans developed for EPA, and that is posted in PDF format on the EPA website. So you can see the specifics of that set of spreadsheets by accessing the website. And then, so essentially what it is, it's a set of Excel spreadsheets with a separate tab for each major activity in the remedy. And it takes the inventory, it takes the materials and activities that were involved in the remedies and estimates the materials that are used. And then from those estimates of materials that would be used and activities engaged in, we use life cycle inventory data that's publicly available to essentially transform those materials and activities into things like particulate emissions, CO2 emissions, and so forth. So I hope that's what your question was getting at, but that's how we did it.
Yeah, I guess that is my question. The answer I'm looking for is, you said life cycle, say it again, life cycle.
We use life cycle inventory data that's publicly available to make that transition, essentially, from, for example, a ton of concrete used, how much CO2 is generated in manufacturing or producing that ton of concrete. So that's what I mean by using life cycle inventory data to get from the materials used and to transform that, or to understand what are the emissions resulting and what is the footprint resulting from that material used.
And you said that's publicly available. Is that do they show that, where they got that on the website?
Yes, the final report on our website and the spreadsheets contain all of that information, all of our references for where we got our life cycle inventory data. And in some cases, we did back-of-the-envelope calculations for our own, where we couldn't find information on publicly. We made our own estimates, and that's also documented in the spreadsheet.
All right, thank you. You did answer the question. Thank you.
Okay, next question. On the last presentation, have you looked at net environmental benefits? What is the energy consumed, pollutant release during remediation versus the amount of contaminant removed from the site? Are we generating more pollution through the remediation activities than what we're actually cleaning up? So net environmental benefits, did we look at that?
We did not look at that. We didn't do that analysis that was just described there. So
okay.
That could be a next step. Probably more appropriate from a programmatic point of view, in other words, across a whole program in Region 9, where are we getting the best environmental, the best reduction in our footprint versus overall what are our reductions in contaminants. But the short answer to the question is, for this pilot study, we did not do that part of the analysis.
I'll take another question from the phone.
Yeah, I have a question. We've talked a lot about green remediation and talked a little bit about sustainability, and I think Karen's presentation really moved more towards the big picture that relates to sustainability. I'm curious as to what EPA's definition is of green versus sustainable.
I can take a shot at that, unless somebody else on the line wants to. Let me go ahead. So, and the most simplistic point of view or approach, sustainable includes economic as well as social components, in addition to the environmental components. So there's those three main components. Whereas when we talk about green and green remediation, we're talking about primarily the environmental component. So let me just start with that, kind of basic observation, and if the question wants to be more complex or nuanced than that, we can continue.
I think it would get into too long of a discussion, so I think that's a good clarification.
Okay, we have a question from someone asking, how many hours of time did it require for you to perform the three analysis, including time from your consultant? This person is trying to get a handle on what it would require for a project manager to do this sort of analysis, Karen.
Thanks, Nikos. It's a really good question. It took a huge amount of time, a huge amount of resources, not only from our contractor, but also from EPA, myself, close oversight and involvement. Elapsed time was 8 months for both for the ROMIC analysis as well as the BP Wood River analysis. I actually don't know the number of contractor hours. But it was a lot of effort.
You know that you never do deals this time, and I can pick them up for free with package pickup.
Perfect. So I guess we have somebody who put us on hold.
Oh, I should have brought my flat. Priority mail flat rate shipping starts at 4:90. A simpler way to get.
We need to go with the global mute.
There it is.
You know her. We know them. Together, we'll make her holiday. That's why only there is the Diamond Store, where you'll get an extra 10% off store-wide, now through...
Please be advised that today's seminar is now over. For the date and time of the next seminar, please visit the Kluwen Studio at http://.
Just in case I lose you all again, I want to say that we have a couple of seminars coming up. If you enjoyed this one and want more of this type of stuff, it'll be different material. It's not a repeat of this one, but similar sort of mix of policy discussion and case studies, real-world case studies. The next one is on Tuesday, January 11th, 2011, from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And then the final one in the series on February 10th, 2011, from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hillary, if I may just add one last quick comment for whoever may still be on the line. I just wanted to emphasize that that 8 months for a footprint analysis was for the very detailed and exhaustive footprint analysis, and we are expecting that for a typical site, for a streamlined footprint analysis, it would be more like 3 or 4 weeks of contractor time and would fit in nicely into a typical feasibility study and or a typical corrective measure study in RCRA. So just wanted to emphasize that.
All right. Well, we, by my clock, have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to try to squeeze in one more question here. Is there a plan within any EPA regions to require such a LIFE and LCA tool to be used in remedy selection? I'm not aware of that requirement, but if anybody else would care to respond to that, that question comes from Canada. Not hearing
Frank
any...
Sherman, again, like Hillary said, that there isn't any requirement at this point. There may be some sort of policy or guidance, sort of a loose sort of guidance that headquarters will be providing to our regions, not that it must be done, but that if a region decides to do it at a site, headquarters is likely going to be putting together a methodology for how they would do it if they chose to.
With that, thanks everyone for participating, and thanks very much to the speakers for presenting. It was nice to have you, and I hope to have you back again on January 11th, 2011, at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Look for another announcement in the next issue of Tech Direct. Thanks, everyone.